To me, the X-Men became about, it was actually about adults versus children, because I felt that the whole thrust of the X-Men was actually about the generational thing, that people dislike their children because new ways of looking at things, and adults kind of don't like that because it's threatening to them. So I saw the X-Men as being about that, and basically that's where we took it in that direction, basically about the war between adults and youth.
But I don't know if don't look at me.
I'm looking at you.
You got yourself into that.
I'm looking at you for validation, Stan. It's all I want.
You are listening to E for Evolution, examining Grant Morrison's X-Men, and we are your hosts. I'm Perry.
Hi there, I'm Oscar.
I'm Pat.
How are you guys doing today?
I'm good. We had a little burst of summer in Sydney, and now the weather gods have made it cold again. But other than that, I'm good.
I'm good. It's the weekend. It's good to be away from campus because all the kids are back, and it's kind of making me a little bit more antsy than usual. So,
yeah, we got most of my university classes are going to be online this year, but two of them are going to be on campus, and that's going to be starting up in like 2 weeks, I think. I'm not looking forward to that direct drive again.
Forward to being back in class again, though?
Well, this school, we've always been. I started working at this school last year, and they've always been, and they never closed down at all, which has been stupid because every few weeks, a student tests positive, and they shut us down for a week, and we got to do online for another week. The other university I work at, they just like, no, you can be online. If it's your choice. If you want to be online, you can be online. If you want to do hybrid, do hybrid. If you want to be in person, you have to put in a request. So I just said, do it all online. And it's just been so much easier that way.
For sure. It boggles my mind that there are companies or schools that aren't just doing it as a default for the time being. Just do it as a default.
Yeah. Especially because it's university English class. Like, the students never actually interact anyway. So there's no real reason for it. But anyway. But today we're talking about something a little bit more pleasant. I guess more pleasant in one way, is not so pleasant for the characters, but we're talking about New X-Men number 121, which is the return of Frank Whiteley as artist, Grant Morrison's writing as always, Richard Starkings doing the lettering, Hi-Fi design is the colors, Pete Franco assistant editor, Mark Powers editor, Joe Quesada editor-in-chief, Bill Gemmis, president, and this is the issue's titled Psychic Rescue in Progress. And this is this was a kind of like a little gimmick thing that Bill Gemmis had an idea to do back in the day, where he was inspired by, there had been a Deadpool issue that Christopher Priest did, which was an all silent issue, and it was influenced by something that the G.I. Joe comics had done in like the 80s or early 90s, I think it was. And so Christopher Priest did kind of like a spoof on that, like doing an all silent issue. And Bill Gemmis thought it was a great idea. So he did this edict that for 1 month, every single book in the line was going to be a silent issue, no dialogue, no text. It was just going to be all driven by the art. And it was called the Nuff Said Month. So what were your guys' thoughts before we talk about this issue specifically about the Nuff Said thing as kind of a whole?
I really am struggling to remember the other ones besides this one. Like, I cannot recall any of the other ones. Like, I know they did them. I know they exist. And in the back of my mind, my brain is, yeah, you read them, but I can't tell you what they were about other than this one. So,
wow. remember being, I remember hearing about it and getting a little bit upset, thinking like, oh, you know, I'm going to pay for this comic and it's going to be read in 2 seconds. And thinking, you know, I'm not going to get my money's worth if there's nothing to read. But the memory that I bring back from it now is that, and I'm a little bit like you, Pat, there were some that I couldn't remember. So in preparation for this podcast, I went and read quite a few of them. And at the time, this issue in particular solidified what made Morrison such a great writer, because it's so far and above beyond better than any of the other issues. It's like really separates the oil and the water in terms of the craft of writing. And this issue was the one where I was like, okay, now I get why everyone was so excited about Morrison coming on board and blowing everything out of the water.
And I think not just Morrison, but quietly too. Like, I think there's just, like, I think in comics there's some what I call dynamic duos, like like writer artist teams just go together, like McKelvey and Gillen is another one. And I think this issue really showcases how and why, like, quietly and Morrison were just sort of made to work with each other. I feel like they bring out the best in each other, I feel like.
Oh yeah, I think so too. And I remember a few of the other Enough Said issues. The only ones that really, because I was working at a comic book store back when these were coming out, so I read like everything Marvel put out at the time. And the only ones I remember really standing out was, I remember the X-Men ones really clearly, because the Uncanny X-Men one, that was actually kind of a, that was kind of a clever thing, because they had that as the return of Banshee. So you have a silent issue with the guy who's got, whose power is a sonic scream. And I always loved Banshee. So it was cool to see him back. And that was the beginning of the X-Corps storyline. And then the Extreme X-Men one, that was confusing.
I reread that just last night, actually, that one. And what happened when I read it, I was like, okay, Claremont hasn't done anything different. He hasn't approached the writing to this issue that's all silent in any way, shape, or form differently than he would have done any other issue. All he's just done is removed the speech and the text squares. That's it. There's nothing else that he's done differently. Morrison really does everything differently to just show the different ways that you can communicate with symbols and body language and perception and just, yeah. Claremont did nothing. He just wrote a book and took out all the text.
That's really what I felt too. Sorry, Pat, go ahead.
What can you give me like a quick recap? Like what happened in the Extreme issue?
So that was like during...
And the notion of Claremont not having speech bubbles sounds insane to me. Like how he must have been like, oh, I can't.
Especially because
he was just like, I'm not going to bother. I'm just going to do the same and put out the issue the same. And you can just take out the speech bubbles and that's it.
And also because, and it was during the, and Claremont's a very old school writer, right? He came up during the, doing the Marvel Method stuff where you just, and so he would always do the dialogue after. And I think he had to switch over to full script back when Quesada came on board, because that was like the edict that Marvel passed that was like everything had to be full script from that point on. So I think he was definitely struggling with that as a big part of it as well, because he wasn't just doing the dialogue in after the fact. But he just, but yeah, like Oscar said, it was just like he had written the story but just deleted all the dialogue. And Pat, to answer your question, it was during that like two or three issue arc where they had Sebastian Shaw come back and Lady Mastermind, and they were trying to manipulate Sage. And it was, you're doing a mind control issue with like reality warping and without any sort of text or explanation. And it's just like things change from one panel to the other and you have no idea what's happening because it's just completely free of any sort of context.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right.
It was really hard to follow. There'd be pages of of characters, and then there'd been one panel of a character who's not even at that scene, and then it would just go on to another completely mm-hmm. different scene, and you'd be like, why is that? It was really dumb. The one thing with these silent issues that was really great for me as well, and this goes across the board with all of them, but I found it not in the digital copy, which was really disturbing, but it was the first time I ever read a comic script.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And in the paper ones, which I dug out this time rather than just cheating and going on the digital one, it actually sets out how they've written it with the script, where they're like being so particular with and detailed with what they want the artist to do in every single panel. And it was really cool to read the script. I'd love to read more scripts.
I remember there, I'm not sure if they still have it in print, but there was a Nuff Said trade paperback where they had all the Nuff Said issues collected. And I believe that had all the scripts in the back.
Yeah, well, the new X-Men issue only had like, the script went to page 13. So it was
only partial scripts. Oh,
yeah, okay. It's only half of the script. I tried to find a copy online, but I wasn't able to. But I would love to read more comic scripts.
Yeah, comic scripts. And comic scripts are deceptively hard to write because
I imagine so.
You see them and you think, oh, you know, it's just you write a little bit of dialogue and you write a little description for the artist and that's it. But it's a real, and I've written a lot of comic book scripts, and just from my work as a letterer, that really kind of opened my eyes to how little real estate you have in a comic book panel. And I get scripts sometimes from clients and from writers, and it's just like they want me to fit like, you know, 3 pages worth of dialogue into one panel. It's just like that can't be done. And then you get an artist who fills up the entire panel with a close shot and leaves no room for dialogue.
Luckily, Quietly's work is somewhat minimalist, and so he leaves a lot of space around. But I was incredibly taken back by like going through when you read the issue, yeah, it's great. But when you go through and read the script, you see just how much symbolism is put into the things in Xavier's mind, you know, that I would have had no idea about had I not read the script as well. And with the Claremont issue, when I read the script, I was like, oh, okay, now I know what that person was doing there instead of just having no idea. But yeah, this really, I'll just reiterate what I said at the start. This issue really shows how great of a writer Morrison is.
Yeah. And in fact, this was, if I remember correctly, this was like the most well-received unanimously of all the Nuff Said issues. Even people who hated Morrison back then, like X-Fans who hated Morrison, they loved this issue because it was so well done.
For me, I think it's one of the greatest single comic book issues of all time.
Absolutely, yeah.
Like I don't know where I would rate it in terms of my favorite, but it's definitely in the top 10, the top 5. It's really one of the best issues you could ever give anyone to read. And yeah, incredible.
Or masterclass. And it's interesting that you said masterclass too, because as I was thinking about this issue, like that is the term that kept coming back to me. Like, this is a masterclass in how to do comics.
Right. And how to show, not tell, which is what makes a great comic, is where they show you what's happening, they don't tell you. And also just Morrison captures communication without words, and communication in normal everyday life. You know, we're talking now, but you guys are getting so much more than just my words. You're getting the tone, the delivery, the body language, because we can see each other through the Zoom. There's so much more to communication. And I think it's one of what I really liked that film, A Quiet Place, because, well, not only is it just a fantastic film, but it also goes into, I think, a deeper level of just horror. It's not just horror. It shows you, it shows you about communication and how we communicate with each other with more than just words. This comic does that as well.
Yeah, I want to talk about the cover for, because this is, you know, not only is this one of the best issues, this is one of the best covers Quietly's ever done as well. Like the close-up of just Cassandra's head floating in this void, and like the darkness, the shadows just all over the most of her face. It, and just like the detail on the wrinkles and everything. And then you've got Xavier's head, you know, with shadows of prison bars over the eyes like that. It's just, everything is composed beautifully in this cover.
Mm-hmm. And it's sort of a part of the covers of the run that connect with the story inside. Mm-hmm. So again, sort of like that pinup kind of approach, but it's indicative of what the reader's going to encounter in the issue.
Yeah,
it really does show you in one clear image what the story is about. Mm-hmm. I am not on the same page as you here, Percy, in that I don't think it's one of the greatest covers. I think it's good. Mm-hmm. I do think it's good. I don't think it's the greatest. When I first looked at it, I thought it had something to do with like Kang.
Hmm.
Oh, I could see that.
Yeah.
That's the first thing I thought when I first saw it. And so that sort of loses marks for me there with those lines going down instead of the jail bars.
Yeah.
But it does everything it's supposed to do. I just don't know that it's the best.
It's one of my favorites from that Quietly has done, at least. And I think maybe more than any other, I think this cover is most clearly connected to what happens inside the issue. Than any other during this run.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? I see the Kang connection. You know what I always think when I look at this is I think Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now. Like, you know, in the end scenes there when he comes in with the face paint on and he tosses the head in to Martin Sheen. It really reminds me of that part of the movie.
There's definitely some sort of psychotic element to it. Mm-hmm. One thing that I do say, just to be another slightly more critical as I'm already being, but I never understood, or even just when I'm looking at the image now, I didn't know which one was Cassandra and which one was Xavier.
I think the head is Cassandra because it has a lot more wrinkles than, because I think Quietly always drew her with like slightly more wrinkles than he did with Xavier.
And it's Xavier Xavier locked trapped in the mind of her body.
Right.
But and even also, though we know that's the story, I think when I look at the image, I can't tell straight away.
Mm-hmm. I can see that. I also think that I never noticed this before, but the black eyes, it really kind of helps speak to the fact that her body is, you know, just an empty shell for him. It's just a prison now. Sorry, Paco. Yeah,
And I think he draws Cassandra sort of with more angular features. I think he draws Charles with a more like full cheek and jowls, whereas Cassandra is sort of more severe and angular. Mm-hmm. But I think the similarities to their features work in the cover, in the image's favor, right? Because there's just notion of like they're twins, they're each other's opposites. And, you know, it's kind of hard to tell which one is which, right?
Yeah. Okay, let's jump inside. Right from the start, like Morrison works, like he gives one of the problems with a lot of these Nuff Said issues is they didn't have a reason for them to be silent. They just, and a lot of mm-hmm. them were like mid-story yes. arcs, so they just, mm-hmm. you know, they just kind of like, okay, we're gonna do a part of the story that's just gonna have no text then. But Morrison really worked the silence into the story, like right from the start, right? With the sign, silent psychic rescue in progress.
Yeah, I don't know if it was just luck or planning, but I just love how organic that was. Mm-hmm. Like it was part of the ongoing story. It made a lot of sense for it to have no words whatsoever. So I don't know, like maybe they planned their schedule around his story schedule or whatever it is, but I really liked how well it flowed into the overall arc.
I think that that's not giving Morrison enough credit. Like Morrison understood the assignment
mm-hmm.
and was
mm-hmm. yes,
and to be able to integrate, you know, this to make the silence the theme I think it was it Joe Casey that was writing Uncanny X-Men at that time, I think?
Yeah, so he did the Banshee one.
Yeah, so he did the Banshee story. There's a fantastic element there about sound that you could write the story about with Banshee. And, you know, he could have finished with a huge scream or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But we're holding back, and then suddenly just bursting out with a scream throughout the end of the issue. That makes it about sound.
Mm-hmm.
Claremont done the issue with Lady Mastermind taking over their bodies. That's another good way to not use sound, by making everything psychic and being on the psychic plane or whatever. Everyone got the same assignment, but Morrison was the only one that truly understood and just took it to another level. If you were marking students' work and this was their assignment, Morrison gets the high distinction.
Yeah,
because of the way that he incorporated silence as the theme rather than just the gimmick.
Yeah, I think everyone had the same instruction and got the same lead time. But I think the problem was a lot of writers were just like, "Oh, I'll just do a regular issue, and you know, I'm not gonna plan my stories around this one gimmick thing." Which, you know, I think it kind of spoke to the kind of, you know, because there was a lot of tension between Jemis and a lot of creators at that time. So I think a lot of them were just like, you know, okay, fine, I'll do an issue that's silent, but I'm not going to change my plans for it. And there are other writers like Morrison, like Casey, who had done better planning about it. And Fabian Nicieza as well. I think his Nuff Set issue was also playing on sound, like with Songbird, and it was a Songbird story. I remember that, and that was also one that was really well done.
I remember something about apparently whoever was writing Thor at the time, apparently the Thor issue got a lot of high praise as well, but I didn't read that one. But
I think that was Dan Jurgens, if I'm remembering correctly.
People are going to go back and read through these silent issues. This one in particular, you know, that was so good because they just redid a Giant Size X-Men, right? Where they where it's a complete homage.
Yep.
To this remix. Issue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the remix. I like that, Pat.
Or I when I read that Giant Size issue, like, perhaps like a cover version might be the more accurate term.
Yeah, take it. I'll take it. One thing I'd like to say about this opening page, with the art in particular with Quietly, is that we really, in the first opening issues of their run, the faces of the characters were a bit, for lack of a better term, ugly.
Mm-hmm.
But now they're not. Mm-hmm. And one of the great things I like about his art is that the faces are starting to look different for each character. And I feel like, especially Jean Grey in the scene, in the panel where she's sort of to Logan and Scott, I feel it really looks like Famke Janssen from the films.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even if their hairstyles of Jean and Emma were the same, their faces look different. Yeah. Jean's is like a narrow and Emma has a more round face. And I just love when artists make the character look different without having to look at their costume to know which one it is.
Yeah,
and Emma is wearing her sexy costume.
She's wearing this is one of the few times she actually wears it. Yeah,
indeed, it's her psychic rescue outfit.
I love the detail too in just like the little wires and everything. Like he puts a lot of detail into that. The little displays all around him, and even just like their hair. Right, I mean they both have their hair pulled back. But even that is styled differently in both of them. I like that. And go ahead.
No, that X-ray image of Cassandra's body is posed in a way that her body is posed on the wheelchair, which is some great attention to detail as well.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also the mentions of all the different organs here, right? That's something that we're going to get explained in the next issue because of all the different diseases she left riddled in her body to incapacitate Charles.
Mm-hmm.
I love how before they dive into, and just the nutshell of the story, I don't think we've mentioned it yet, is that Jean and Emma are going into Xavier's brain to sort of save him from Cassandra, or just pull him out. And just before they go to do the psychic dive in, Emma has a quick shot of whiskey from the bottle first. I love that.
Mm-hmm. And so, and a couple of things to piggyback on that too. One, I think, so there's that panel here where I think is one of the rare instances where you see the back of that outfit.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you're right.
So like, perhaps it solves the mystery that people can't seem to stop thinking about. Just how does it stay on? Well, there you go. And I also would like to hear, I mean, if there was one question I can ask Emma at this point, I'm like, where did you hide that flask? Where was it?
In her handbag.
What? Okay. Okay.
Don't you know, have you guys seen Mary Poppins?
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course.
I always thought that was like just a Mary Poppins thing until I've been out with girls and they've opened their handbags up and they've hundreds of things. I think, oh my God, this is why girls don't have pockets. Because you've got handbags. There's no pockets that would be big enough to carry everything that you want.
Speaking of the flask, and Oscar, this goes to something you were saying at the beginning about the body language, right? Just like this, you know, Emma's just got this, you know, so what type of look on her face almost. And she's glancing down at Jean. And it's like Jean is, you know, giving her a what the hell's wrong with you type of look.
And it's such a, I love this page because it allows that kind of interaction and the reader sort of fills in like whatever snarky bit they must be thinking at each other. And all of that is conveyed with just images and body language and facial expressions. But it's still so clear, like you know what Morrison wanted and it's on the page.
And I like the use of the color here in these last two panels signify that they're going in. And then this is one of my favorite images of this issue, right? The splash page of them going inside his head with, you've got the outline of his head as, you know, as right, you can see right at the top, it's the outline of his head. And then just like this swirling effect is, I don't even know how quietly drew this. Like it's like a
whirlpool, right?
Yeah.
And your eye follows the whirlpool. So even though it's just one page, it displays movement in such a great way.
And I think one of the marks of a really good comic is that if you can come back to it again and again and find new things. And to this day, like I keep finding new tidbits in this page that I've never seen before. Like the fact that she's sort of poking her finger in his temple. So there's always something new when I come back to it, which is, like you said, Perry, it's one of my favorite pages as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just in awe of this, just as an artist trying to figure out, like, how did he do that? Because, like, I know there had to have been some sort of, you know, photoshopping or manipulation done here, most likely, but it's just, like, I still cannot wrap my brain around how he drew this. It's just... I would love to see Quitely's original pencils for this and see like how he had gotten this done.
Yeah, I mean, like Oscar said earlier, it's a masterclass that you want to take.
Yeah.
When you read the script as well, like I read the script, I'm going to keep referring back to it because it's so great. And it's the first and only time I've had really an opportunity to read a script and then see it on the page. Quitely does such a great job of it, but Morrison is the one that envisioned it in his brain. And to just describe it as like six panels arranged in concentric circles, like ripples on a target, and then individually describe what he wants inside each one of those circles. I would love to have seen Quitely's face when the script arrived. He's like, how the fuck am I going to draw this? But maybe he was like, cool, let's get to it. I don't know. But for me, I'd be like, I'd struggle.
Yeah, I think probably because they've worked together so often in the past before this. So I think he's probably like, okay, I know what you want. And plus, I think Morrison's an artist himself. So I do know that he has done in the past, like he's done like layouts and stuff like that, so to give the artist an idea of what is in his head. And that's a real benefit, having a writer who is also an artist, because they can do that. Because it can be, and that's, again, one of the challenges of writing comics, is trying to convey exactly what you want, but also trying not to stifle the artist's creativity at the same time.
And speaking of new things that I just discovered, like I never saw that before, where the top part of the page actually carries the image over from the last panel. So yeah, you see like their silhouettes touching Charles. Yeah, it's just an amazing page. I can just look at it all day.
You could. One of the things that I didn't realize, that just to go back into how much thought he puts into it, in the script he mentions that, that in that page there'll be lots of things like a crutch, and it says all these things are associated with the letter X according to his trusty abecedarium. So dreamlike things like the wood fish sculpture that's rotting, the papers and the photographs of his people in his past. All of that stuff has some connection that I would just never have known.
Yeah.
I read the script as well, but he put so much thought into everything.
Yeah, I was wondering about the fish myself. And this is another great page, the splash page of them in Charles's mind and seeing the castle off in the distance, or the tower. And I'm trying to figure out, you know, Oscar, maybe you have some insight on this because you've got the script pages here, like what exactly these symbols are supposed to mean. I mean, obviously, you know, the first one, you know, we have, you know, two women. Then we have this other one where it's just a single woman with a question mark.
So what when I read it, I looked at Jean's, says, you know, should one of us go over there? And Emma's like, no, we should both, like, we're going to both do it. So that's why when in Jean's symbol, it's one woman with a question mark, and then Emma's like two women with a tick.
Oh, so I see.
When I read that, it was like, should one of us go? And Emma's saying, no, we're here together. Let's work as a team.
Yeah, I think it was, to me, it's similar to that. It's like the sort of classic horror movie question of, do we split up or do we stick together?
I like this one. Apparently, like, Emma's sneering. And then, yeah, you're right. This makes a lot more sense. Like, it's them communicating with each other. So Gene's like saying, you know, we have to go to the castle type of thing.
So in the script, it says, Gene's head and shoulders in the foreground looks off the panel with a determined frown. In the background, a narrow set of stone stairs, which descend between the tenements to the beach, we see Emma. She can't go any further than where she is. We see Jean's thoughts form a purple neon pictogram in the air near her head. They should translate as, he's been imprisoned, a mental construct, a trap for himself. Emma's telepathic symbols float in the air in front of her, glowing purple like neon, reading, and then it doesn't say anything. It says, we'll talk about them later. So that's the rest of them aren't coming up on the script there. They've obviously figured that out later. Mm-hmm. But I like the other one where it's the castle, right? They're pointing at the castle with a question mark. And for me, I read that symbol as, should we go that way? And then the next panel, it's the question mark with a two, a cross, and another question mark. Mm-hmm. So I read that as, is this us going to our death?
Hmm.
Oh, I see. Yeah. That makes a lot more sense then. The look of surprise here as Cassandra strikes back at Emma. And again, the Quietly's motion, you know, his art, this like kinetic feel of the artwork, like here with her clothes being blown off, and here with the smoke, it's got that very kind of kinetic feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
I love the faces in the doors, right? Here they're smiling and then here they're frowning. And then we just have Emma naked in her diamond form.
With that diamond pictogram too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. I really like, in terms of the what you mentioned there with his quietly sense of movement, we see that with Gene walking across the bridge towards the castle of Xavier's mind and her hair sort of developing into that phoenix.
This is one of the most beautiful sequences that Quitely has ever drawn, in my opinion. Like, it's just, it's flawless.
It really is cinematic too. Mm-hmm. Like, they've got that widescreen comics as they were describing it. You can really see that in terms of this scene with Jean creating that bridge as she walks along.
Mm-hmm. I think sort of replicating what Ian McKellen did in the movie.
Yes.
I was thinking the exact same thing. Yeah.
Cooler, dramatic fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like the very, not so subtle, but still kind of subtle sort of nod to the phoenix with her hair. Sort of a nice, non-intrusive way to keep that story arc fresh in everybody's minds. Like,
I think it is. Yeah, I mean, I notice it now because it's very, because I've read this issue so many times. But when I first, the very first time I read it, I didn't quite catch that. So I think it is subtle enough. And mm-hmm. it was only afterwards, I'm like, oh, I get it. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, like sort of just remind readers, hey, you know, like last issue, she had that big moment and mm-hmm. it's not going to be a one-off and it's going to be a running concern for us.
And something else too is, you know, there's no power aura here. And, mm-hmm. And you know, as a colorist doing some, when I do coloring stuff, it's kind of fun to do those power effects, but it works so well here without having any of that, right? Just the bricks just kind of flowing without seemingly by themselves.
Yeah, there's no, I never realized that there's no glow around the objects that she's moving.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, it's enough. Like, I mean, the display, I think, is enough that adding any more embellishments, I think, would just take away from the effect. But
yeah,
I mean, sort of her feat of like pulling the bricks and making that bridge is enough to convey just how powerful and the kind of force that she's wielding.
It's also, you know, going back to what you guys said, it is so much more cinematic this way than it, because she could easily just fly across, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But this is just, it's just so much more cinematic and such a better use visually of her powers this way.
I mean, I don't know about that. Just, I don't know. Like in my mind, I kind of feel like, yeah, she could just fly away. She could just fly there, mm-hmm. but like she's inside Charles's booby-trapped head or Cassandra's booby-trapped brain. So I think maybe, like, you know, this is the way to sort of circumvent some defenses. Like, mm-hmm. you know, there's a reason for her to be doing this, and it still makes sense in the context of the story because they're not in the real world, right? They're
right.
in the brain of this villainous woman who's set all kinds of traps for them to trip.
I also like, you know, just going back right before the sequence, I like how Quitely draws Emma's uniform growing back around her body, mm-hmm. which again helps drive home the point that this is a psychic realm. So like the regular rules don't apply. I love this. Like, you know, Jean gets blasted off the bridge. She looks back and Emma just sticks her tongue out.
That's a really cool image of Emma sticking the tongue out, being like, I'm not going to help, right? Jean's like, oh, hello, help me. And Emma's like, no, thank you.
It's such a, she's such a brat in that panel, and I love it. And I'm now just realizing that her tongue is also made of diamond. So that's a thing.
That's a weird thing. It's a thing, but it's very weird.
Isn't mm-hmm. it? Because I mean, like the whole time, like it's just her skin, right? No, apparently, no.
No, it's everything. Not. Yeah,
it's everything.
Oh my god! What do you guys think about the brain spitting on Emma?
I'm drawn to the letters. Like I always when I read this issue, try to sort of derive some meaning from them, but I think I've given up. I think it's just basically alphabet soup.
I think
is
so.
What I'm going with.
It's like that SpaghettiOs soup, right?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Yes. But in that disgusting green kind of boogery sick color, of course.
Mm. Well, I mean, you see the letters all over the place too. Like here, there are mm-hmm. like these ruins around the castle. So I think maybe that's just indicative of part of the motor neuron disease and like other types of diseases she's left in Charles's body where he can't really communicate.
Right. Like he can't make meaning. Like, yeah, exactly. You know, the tools are there, but he can't string them together.
Right. Right. And again, I like this, the kind of a nod to X of Swords. the two swords cross like that.
Mm.
And again, just like this, again, no power signature, right? But she just kind of blows the doors off, pulls them apart. And you can feel the motion in his artwork here as she enters the castle.
And the power as well.
Mm-hmm. And I never noticed this detail in the background here, but like you've got the children's drawings on the background, right? I never noticed those before. And there's so much going on in this panel now that I look at it carefully.
There is. And he writes in the script that Jean walks into the hollow black tower, a weird room filled with symbolic stuff, a bird skeleton in a cage, locked books, a rack of running shoes, gas masks, symbols of suffocation, and fetuses in jars. Twin mm-hmm. stuff is hinted at everywhere. So, yeah, that from that little bit of text,
mm-hmm.
quietly is able to
like in
create this masterpiece.
Well, in this kid's drawing too, right? Because I'm guessing this is supposed to be like Xavier and Cassandra, like going to that twins type stuff. And Xavier's got the pipe like he used to have in the old days.
I looked at it as that's Xavier's parents.
I thought the
I thought too.
For me, I thought the right one was the parents and the left one was the kids.
Okay.
But it looks so happy. Like, you know, like I feel like they wouldn't have had the opportunity to have that moment in their lives,
mm-hmm.
right? Because as we find out, like Charles tried to kill her like right away. But yeah, so I thought they were representative of the parents.
And I like here it's basically his wheelchair, right? All around his head here. I mm-hmm. like that.
I love how it's deconstructed and mm-hmm. all of the parts are pulled out by the screws and it's so detailed.
Yeah.
Also, he looks, you know, like this little man chained down and the head being so disproportionately huge from the rest of his body. It looks painful. It's why he's mm-hmm. like, oh, my head hurts because it's swollen 10 times the size of his body.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of looks like that famous thinker sculpture.
I was thinking statue. The same thing, yeah.
And I really like how there's sort of this subtle kind of like atomic symbol type thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of working to chain him in. It's just one of the great things about this issue is it's such a visual feast and it gives your eyes lots of things to do and follow. It kind of gives me that dopamine rush of like, now I see what he's trying to do here. And that's really cool.
And it also has it also forms a vague X too.
Mm-hmm. And probably more than one angle.
I always saw it as the X rather than the atom. But now that Pat mentions it, it's definitely like an atom.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder what it would look like from another angle, right? Because I imagine that it would probably have that X motif
mm-hmm.
depending on no matter at what side of it you're looking at it from.
Picking up the snow globe. This detail on the snow globe where inside it's not snow, it's little sperm. Yeah.
I think is that a first for a Marvel comic?
Yeah. There's a lot of firsts in this issue. Like there's the first time we see detailed sperm and mm-hmm. the first fetus fight. Maybe ever. The first fetus fight ever.
Don't forget like the sperm penetrating the ovum as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right.
We say the literal conception.
Conception comes a little later.
Yeah. Yes. Contraception should come first, not after, but you know, sometimes it comes after. But anyway, I really like how the art changes when it goes to the scientific. That's how I'll describe it. The scientific elements of the story in terms of the
conception, right? With the sperm going into the egg and mm-hmm. fertilizing and developing into the twins. The arch changes in that way.
Well, it's also sorry, Pat, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, like, I think that's accurate. Like in that page where we see the conception, like mm-hmm. quietly applies this kind of filter to it. So it looks like one of those like movies you might see in science class. Like mm-hmm. when the teacher is born, like here's a video. It's sort of like this, he gives it a kind of filtered grainy quality to it. Like you're watching some kind of science program,
right?
Which works for that page, right?
I also think it's just such a masterful transition, right, from this mm-hmm. the snow globe to the close up on them, and then she's inside with the sperm.
Mm-hmm.
Who ever would have thought that we would be reading a comic book with Jean Grey swimming along a bunch of sperm? Like, I'm so surprised that this got past the editors mm-hmm. and they were like, yeah, go for it. But I think it's indicative of what Marvel was going through at that time in terms of giving the writers real creative freedom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think at that point they were sort of, if not, I think the bankruptcy moment either just passed or they just cut past it shortly. So it was a very kind of experimental phase where maybe they felt like there's very little to lose, so we're just gonna go for it.
I also think it's a huge credit to I don't want to mispronounce his name. I always Quesada,
yeah, that's right.
Quesada. I was almost about to say Quesadilla.
Very similar. Yeah. That's the first. I was just gonna say, think Quesadilla.
Yeah, from now on, I'm just gonna call him Quesadilla because that way I'll remember.
It's very
it.
Close.
So, yeah. Look, I'm white as fuck, so that's it. But yeah, I think it was a big. He is the one to give credit to, because I'm not sure about the previous editors at large, but he is an artist first.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. when he was in charge, I think I imagine him being like, I'm going to be the editor that I wish that I had when I was an artist. And I'm going to give them the freedom to do what they do best. And yeah, I think that's what it is. I think maybe previously they were more corporate minded.
Well, you had, before this, you had Bob Harris was the editor in chief and was just like, he was terrible, right? Like, famously, like all the problems Marvel had in the 90s, all the creative difficulties can be traced to Bob Harris. In fact, when Bob Harris got fired, one of the artists in the background of one of the comics, there was like a bookshelf, and he wrote on the spines, like, haha, Bob Harris got fired. He was an asshole.
Cheeky.
But yeah, that was found out, and that artist was reprimanded, and then the reprints took that out. But but yeah, he was terrible, and like that's why, you know, the X-books were basically stagnant for so long, was because Harris came on as the X-Men editor, and he was like the consultant on the animated series. So the X-Men was like he was more concerned with the X-Men than anything else, and just so much interference because of that.
Yeah, I think that it was a really, this issue in particular, especially, you know, we're talking about the fertilization of the egg and the fetuses having that pretty brutal fight with the fetuses punching each other and choking them to death with the umbilical cord.
That's
crazy.
It's
creepy.
So, especially when you find out that's Charles doing that. Like the first time I read
this. Not Cassandra. It's
Charles. Thought that was Cassandra beating the shit out of Charles, but no.
Mm-hmm. So it's like this weird thing where one can't decide if like did he know she was bad or was he just this malevolent, like, you're intruding into my space, like, get out.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's Cassandra is the baby that's trying to kill Charles, and then Charles uses his powers to push her away.
No, I think it's the other way around.
No, it's the other way around. Like, Cassandra seems, you know, she was just slumbering seemingly peacefully, and then Charles was just like, bam. punch you in the face.
That's crazy. We both read. I've read that. I've always read it the other way.
I've read it your way first, Oscar. But at the end, when Gene says that, you know, he tried to kill his twin sister in the womb, that mm-hmm. made me think that, because that's not kill is more intentional, right? What's happening in this last panel? That's self defense.
Right.
So that's why I took that as using the energy was being Cassandra, and then the one doing the punching was Charles. Kind of like he detected her malevolence at an early age is what I kind of read it as.
The reason why I put it that way is because when he shoots the telepathic thing, that's what kills the other one. Right?
I don't think I think that's what triggered the labor, I think, but I don't think that actually killed one of them.
Okay.
And then one of them was stillborn is how I read it. Right. It's kind of like, that's one thing that's not really made clear is exactly how Cassandra is, you know, like what she is, because they say in the next issue, which we'll get to soon, about like she grew a body for herself and all that kind of stuff. So it was never really 100% clear about that, I felt.
Until I think like Mike Carey's run, because he brought back this concept of, I think, what did they call her?
The Mumudrai.
The Mumudrai later on. So we get a bit more sort of flesh to the concept.
And this is the first time we see Gene using the power signature in the mindscape here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, pulling the castle apart, mm-hmm. taking it all down. I remember reading an interview, I tried to find it again so I could get the exact quote down, with Morrison, and they asked about Quietly's work, and Morrison described Quietly's work as Disney princess gone bad. And I thought, really? But then I look at this image in particular, accurate. Of Gene standing mm-hmm. there, and it's exactly what it is. It's
yeah.
a Disney princess gone bad.
I wouldn't say gone bad, but maybe like Disney princess goth, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
But even with the power signature, it's there, but still very subtle.
Very subtle, yeah.
Not intrusive. And it's sort of an echo of her earlier feat, because, I mean, she's basically like deconstructing that tower into bricks like she was doing before.
One thing I'm just noticing now when I'm looking at the way she's standing, it's also indicative of that religious iconography again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's almost the same pose from the last issue.
Yeah.
Like she had that raptor moment.
Right, except this, yeah, her legs are apart in this one. They were mm-hmm. together in the last one. That's really the only difference. I like this use of the letters here.
Well, I remember when I first read it, and I thought I did have this thought. I was like, oh, I think that maybe Morrison cheated a little bit in this silent issue by including some words that you can read.
I think so, a little bit, yeah. But I mean, at the same time, he put so much more effort into the rest of this that so many other writers didn't, that I think we can give him a pass.
For sure. And it's an inventive way of using the letters. It is inventive, but it's still slightly cheating.
Yeah, but I mean, it bends the rules, but I don't think it breaks them. I mean, no one is talking, mm-hmm. technically.
True.
I also like this scene of, you know, Scott and Logan waiting, and it's the opposite of what you'd expect each of them to do. Like, Logan is the one who's reading a book and Scott's the one listening to music, when you'd probably think it'd be the other way around.
One of the things I really like about this image that I thought of when I was rereading it for this podcast is that what they're doing is both something that you do in silence.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So it's still using the silent theme.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic.
Yeah, and but with Scott, like from his perspective, it's not silent. So it's sort of a
but
nice
it still
way.
Is silent, right? Because if you walk into a room and you see someone listening to their iPod, you're not hearing anything.
Mm-hmm.
You as the viewer are seeing silence.
Yeah, so you're right, but I think it's a good way to sort of incorporate this notion of I don't know, like fidelity, like it so everything is quiet, but the quietness doesn't feel forced or contrived. Like, yes, there's still things happening in the scene where you're like, oh, okay, this is just a regular scene in a hallway. There's somebody listening to music, but still within the rules of the assignment, right?
And I like the subtle way things happen here, right? You see the silence light is on, and then obviously Logan hears a sound or something because he looks, and Scott obviously can't hear because he's listening to the headphones. And the light turns off. They're both standing and waiting, and the door just opens slightly. Very, very good use of the sign. Very good use of storytelling and, you know, sequential story art in that sequence.
Definitely. And the last page where Emma and Jean walk out of the room, I think is such an iconic image of this run. It's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. And this is another cheat too, right? With her speaking directly.
Right. Yeah, but yeah, it's fine. This one I forgive because it's the end, right? Mm-hmm. It's the end of the issue, and we get that pow pow punch of text that Morrison normally uses at the start of the issue. I loved it. I thought it was perfect. This, he gets a tick for this use of the text. I don't feel like this one was cheating.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that it's earned too.
It is. Yeah.
It's a nice cap to sort of that earlier sequence with the embryo and the conception. I have to ask you too, though, like, why do we think that Logan and Scott needed to be quiet? Because I feel like that door is pretty thick and you couldn't hear anything when they were in there.
I was wondering that myself. Like, this is the weird thing about this issue, right? Because he gives you a reason for there to be silence. Cause you know, well, we need silence because it's a psychic rescue. But then when you think about it, you're like, why do you need silence for that?
Mm-hmm. Maybe if there was like a loud bang or something that would distract their bodies from the psychic rescue. I look at it as in when you're waiting in a doctor's office or a hospital, and it even looks almost like a hospital. Mm-hmm. And you don't really sit there and chat. You just sit there in silence.
Mm-hmm.
Or like bus stop or something like that. You're sitting there waiting.
But again, it's kind of a contrivance that I'm willing to forgive Morrison for because of everything else in the issue.
Yeah, I mean, that's like I said, that's why it's a little bit weird because it's both a reason for it, but it also doesn't really make, it's a reason that doesn't really make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine because so many other writers doing this just didn't have any reason at all for people to just randomly stop talking for a whole issue. And I think also going back to what Oscar said about forgiving the speech here at the end, this makes you realize, this kind of helps work in the issue's favor too, because it shows you they're not being silent just to be silent. They had a reason to be silent, and then the rescue's over, so they don't have to be silent anymore. So I think that was a really good use of it as well.
I think as well it provided a real contrast to every single other panel that's in the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And that contrast increases the volume of the silence, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how much Richard Sarkin's got paid to do just this one, these two stories.
I hope she signed a contract. I have a minimum, so it doesn't matter how many bubbles I do. So
because like I've done issues, I've lettered issues where it's just like whole pages where there's no text, just like okay, that's still part of my fee because that you paid me a page rate. But yeah, this would have taken like 5 minutes for him to do, if that.
But I think it's also a nice way just to sort of clarify the stakes and to make clear what was happening in that sequence, but it also reframes it for some people, right? Because it's hard to just like, you can't really tell like which fetus is who, right? So Jean giving this dialogue does a nice job of reframing what we saw, like, oh, like that's not what I thought that was. In fact, it's the complete opposite. Like Charles was the aggressor in that situation.
Yeah, because that surprised me at this part when I first read it. Because I'm like, oh, I thought that was Cassandra who's doing the beating.
Yeah, logically, right? Mm-hmm. Like you would think that.
Okay.
Love this issue so much. I really love this issue, and it's one of the great things about comics as a medium, that you can produce a book with no or very little text and it still be so deep and so fantastic and so fun to read. I just want to give a shout out to a recent issue of Runaways. I think it was Runaways issue 37. And that was also a silent issue. And I didn't realize it was a silent issue until I was well three quarters of the way through the book. I was like, hang on, this is a silent issue. And it was not the same level as this new X-Men comic, but it was really, really good. So if people have read this silent issue and really enjoyed it, I would strongly encourage them to check out Runaways issue 37 of the most recent, unfortunately now cancelled, series.
Good. Any other thoughts about 120? This is 121.
121.
I think this is the only one of, or if not the only comic ever that in my experience that was good enough and iconic enough to get that kind of remix treatment that we mentioned earlier. Like, I can't think of any other issue that got redone again. Like, it was just so good. They had to do it again.
I agree. I can't think of, I've seen plenty of like, I'll steal your term there, Pat, remix covers for issues, and maybe even sort of remixed stories, but they revisit a story in terms of like, well, I guess you can say Morrison does that with revisiting Phoenix or things like that. But this is a comic that was remixed almost panel by panel. That's incredible. That shows how great this was. I think that stands a testament of time, really.
I mean, I haven't read the issue you guys are talking about, because yeah, I do everything by trades when they come on sale, so I'm really behind. I'm only up to X of Swords right now, so I can't comment about how that works. I mean, there have been some like remix stories and stuff like that, so I'm not, but probably not to the level you guys are talking about with this issue.
Yeah, it's almost panel for panel. The difference is it's Gene and Emma. I think Gene at the start goes and kisses Logan instead of Scott in the more recent one. And they're going in Storm's mind to rescue Storm rather than Xavier. So, you know, the inside of the brain is different. But yeah, definitely worth reading as well.
Yeah, I'm looking for. I'll have to check that out when it eventually gets to trade form. If it's not already, that is.
Have you guys read the Runaways issue?
No, I haven't read any Runaways stuff except for like some of the crossover stuff.
The new series was so good. I'm so upset that got canceled, but it's worth checking out for that that silent issue.
Yeah, I saw the first season of the TV show, and I've been meaning to watch the rest of it, and eventually read the comics. Just they haven't come on sale yet, and my to read pile is massive. They just had a big DC sale, and like everything was like $2 or $3, so I bought like the entire Hellblazer run.
So you got a lot of reading to do.
I got a lot of reading to do. Yeah, I got a whole bunch of essentials and or like epic collections and stuff like that I haven't read yet. Wow. I've got so much stuff. I got the whole Sandman run too. I haven't read all that yet.
Oh, that's a must.
That's a must. Yeah, that I'm saving because it's so dense. So I'm like just
putting it is the, really to it's really full reading. Like yeah, you, yeah. After you've read like an issue, you're like, wow, that's a lot. But it's you know, there's a reason why it's a must. It's up there as one of the best comic runs of all time.
Yeah. I mean, I've read some of the run. I read the first two trades in the past. But I'm gonna be going back through now that I have the whole thing and reading it from the start. Any other final comments on this issue? Like for me, Oscar, like you and like a lot of people back then, there was a lot of criticism of the Nuff Said month because A, it seemed like a gimmick, and B, you're asking people to pay full price for comics that they're not even reading. They're just, you know, looking at the pictures. But, and I was reading single issues back when this came out. This is before I switched to trades. And I did not feel cheated at all when I read this issue.
Not with this issue. Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I felt like I had that feeling before I bought them. And then with this issue, I was like, that was worth it. I would have paid double. Mm-hmm. It's that good.
Yeah. And I think you're right. Like it was a gimmick, but I think Morrison, like Oscar was saying, took the brief and took the gimmick and made something really amazing with it.
Something annoys me is when people label something as a gimmick and they dismiss anything that might come out of it. But a gimmick can still lead to a good story. Like a gimmick is just how it starts. And I think this issue definitely proves that. Like, yeah, it's a gimmick, but he used the gimmick to great effect.
Right. If this is RuPaul's Drag Race, Morrison would have won the episode.
Shantae would have stayed.
The lip sync has been won by this issue for sure. It's great. It's crazy when you think about it, it did start as a gimmick. That is fair. Mm-hmm. And what come out of it was one of the greatest single issues of comics ever written.
Mm-hmm.
We need another one. I think we're overdue for Enough Said Month.
I think I'd be wary about mandating everyone do it because, you know, there were so many crap comics that came out of that because so many writers just didn't care about doing it. So I'd be wary about, like, I think it should be encouraged. You know, if it, like, maybe if you guys want to do something like that, or if you can find a way to make it work, but I think forcing it would be something I wouldn't do.
Because people have seen now, people have an idea of, you know, everyone would have read this issue. They could see, you know, this is what we want. This is the standard that must be kept, not the Claremont issue or even the Casey issue.
The problem is that I think most people would say, yeah, this is more the exception than the rule.
Yeah, that's true.
Right.
That is true.
Okay. So I think that about does it for issue 121. One of the best issues of this run, one of the best, you know, like you guys said earlier, one of the best comic books ever, single issues ever published, I'd say too. Guys, you got anything you want to promote before we close up this episode?
Yeah, people can see my ramblings on Twitter at ODAT220.
You can find me on Tumblr at Perfect Fabricated Killing Machine, and my other podcast, Krakoan Exports, is still going, posting new episodes, so check that out.
Okay, and for my part, all my stuff can be found at PercivalConstantine.com, and I've got my other podcast as well, Superhero Cinephiles, if you're interested in superhero movies. Our website, eforevolution.transistor.fm, and you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at MorrisonXPod. And, you know, please leave us a review if you like what you're hearing. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you listen. Thanks so much for listening, and we will talk to you next time when we begin the Imperial story arc. E for Evolution, examining Grant Morrison's X-Men, is produced by Percival Constantine, with theme music by Aaron Kenny. Audio of Grant Morrison and Stan Lee was recorded at San Diego Comic-Con 2008 and provided by bravogabo.livejournal.com. You can find E for Evolution on Twitter and Instagram at MorrisonXPod and on the web at eforevolution.transistor.fm. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our email address is eforevolutionpodcast@gmail.com. Support the show by leaving us a review at Apple Podcasts, which helps us reach more listeners. Special thanks to the members of the House of X Facebook group for their encouragement in getting this show started.